Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Single Tracks Podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is John Calendrill. John has spent decades designing and patenting everything from derailleurs and shifters to dropper posts and brake levers. He's consulted for industry brands including TRP and Box, and now he's got his own company, Vivo, that sells a customizable 12-speed shifter, the Vivo F3. Thanks for joining me, John.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about your background. How did you first get into designing bike components?
Well, I just wanted to find a way to get into the industry back in 91, 92, riding bikes. I was doing cross country races, and a friend of mine, we went to a race in Mount Snow, Vermont. I think it was 91 or 92. And we were just, you know, just so into the whole scene and the racing and the equipment and the people surrounding the sport and the, you know, the businesses, the tech support. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was just like, how can I do this full time? Huh. You know, how can I make my 9 to 5 require me to ride, or I should be going to these events because I need to. So I just wanted to try and get into the industry any way I could. Huh. And the first crazy idea that I came up with was called the Grunge Guard, which was just a rubber boot that protected, you know, front and rear derailleurs. Mm-hmm. Actually, I probably had, maybe a short list of 5 ideas that I could just create as an intro product. And the Grunge Guard was kind of the most unique and craziest. So I decided to pursue that.
Mm. So did you have like a design background? Were you like designing other things and were like, I want to do bike stuff so I can be around bike people?
Yeah, pretty much. I went to school for industrial design, which is basically product design. And I've been working in New York City, as a consultant for a lot of firms, designing anything from packaging to baby bottles to toothbrushes to, you know, airline interiors.
Wow.
You know, when you work at a consultant design firm, you know, you're part of a team, and whatever customers they bring in from whatever industry, it could be any industry, you know, you go through an education process and then you start designing that product for that client. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the variety was really wide and really challenging and always very interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. So many people have that same story about how they got into the bike industry. Like they just really loved it and, you know, try to figure out like where their skills match up with the bike industry. I mean, today, most people, they're going to like start a YouTube channel or something. But being a product designer, like that's definitely something that the industry needs and like really makes a huge impact. So I want to talk about your latest project.
Sure.
The bike shifters. So what are some of the limitations of existing mechanical mountain bike shifters and what makes the Vivo F3 sort of an improvement?
Well, the Vivo F3 is kind of my incarnation of what the ultimate shifter would be. Hmm. You know, obviously there are some awesome shifters out there. SRAM and Shimano have great offerings and TRP as well. I just wanted to kind of take it to the next level. I wanted to bring in some, you know, I love CNC aluminum parts, and I wanted to incorporate 3D, printing. And I wanted to also add the aspect of customizable options, for the consumer. So my shifter, at least, you know, the F3 shifter for now, it's a basic shifter, which basically pulls and releases cable. Mm-hmm. I have some other things coming down the line that, you know, have some additional features. But for this one, it's basically taking the construction to the max, you know, using CNC aluminum, you know, just really lowering the weight, titanium hardware all around. It's got cartridge bearings, you know, for smooth action. I've got, you know, I use different types of aluminums in different parts of the shifter, you know, where they're, you know, have the better performance. I use the 7075. And then the customizable option, you know, in working in the industry, you know, we would design shifters over months. You know, first you perfect the mechanism and then you get into the ergonomics. And a lot of the companies that I worked with, you know, you'd work with, you know, pro riders and, you know, you'd make some samples and you'd get a wide range of input from riders. Mm-hmm. This guy likes the lever over here. That guy likes the lever over there. This guy likes, you know, the lever curved this way, mm-hmm. that way. And so I thought, well, why don't we put that whole process in the hands of the consumer? Hmm. Let them choose what they like, you know, and give them some, you know, incredibly, maybe too many options, but, you know, let them choose the, you know, the texture and the shape and the location and all that stuff. So I wanted to kind of, you know, add that too.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting because, I mean, the shifter, I imagine too, when you're working with brands like TRP and designing like the whole drivetrain, the shifter is probably like not the thing that they spend a lot of time on. And as a consumer, it's not something that like you're going to upgrade, right? Like you're going to upgrade your derailleur or your cassette or all the other parts, but the shifter is kind of like an afterthought, I feel like.
Yeah, I think for a lot of guys too, but for me, I always had a thing for shifters. You know, it was always, you know, it's a contact point, you know, between the bike and the human hand. And for me, it was something I was always fascinated about. I loved, you know, what Shimano was doing as far as their release systems, multi-release and two-way release. Mm-hmm. I liked the ergonomics of the SRAM shifters. So for me, shifters were something I always kind of gravitated to. Hmm. And, because I did some time trial shifters for Vision, you know, back in the day. I did lots of road bike shifters for FSA back in the day. So for me, shifters were always kind of a special thing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too. This kind of brings up another question in terms of like how you design a product like a shifter, where you're saying that you get feedback from riders and it sounds like they're giving you a lot of different feedback, maybe conflicting feedback. Is that pretty common where
sometimes,
you know, people just want, everybody wants something different, or are there times where most people kind of point you in a direction and that's like, you know, that's the good design?
Yeah. Well, in the end, you know, it needs to come down to kind of like a group consensus on what direction we should move in. Mm-hmm. But you know, cockpit layout and hand positioning, I think it's a very personal thing. Mm-hmm. Different riders have different riding styles, bigger hands, smaller hands. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we would get a lot of feedback that was, you know, wide ranged. Mm. People, you know, some people liked certain positions, and then when we would bring it in house, we might say, oh wow, okay, this is not what we thought, but well, this guy's a pro rider, so who are we to question it?
Right.
But, you know, we do, you know, you did need to design for the everyday rider, because this thing was going to go into production. We were going to be making thousands of these things, and we wanted to appeal to the, you know, the widest possible group of consumers.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, so one of the patents that I read that you hold is a combination brake shifter lever. And that's a design that we see, you know, it's pretty standard on gravel and road bikes today. Where did that idea come from?
That must be an old patent. That may have been from the 90s. So I think the idea on that one was basically taking, you know, the integration of brake and shift that traditionally had been done for road for many years. And then I think I was trying to incorporate that into kind of a mountain version. Hmm. And I think one of the aspects of that patent was it had a very, very flat mechanism. So I was trying to minimize, I think, the frontal visual of the shifter.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was a project, if I'm talking about the correct one, that, yeah, I was kind of just borrowing the road technology, trying to bring it into the mountain bike world. Mm-hmm. And it also forced me to come up with a really wacky mechanism to make that work.
Yeah, I bet.
So it was a bit of a challenge, but yeah, I think that was one of the products that just ended up, you know, as a a patent on the wall, and a few, you know, prototypes that I have. I don't believe that went very far.
Hmm. It does seem like it's pretty applicable today in terms of like bike cockpits becoming, you know, they're super cluttered right now, right? With all the controls that we need for dropper posts and, you know, now motors and everything. So yeah, I mean, do you think, is that a problem that we're going to need to keep addressing in terms of like keeping our cockpits clean?
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, a clean cockpit visually, you know, the aesthetic is awesome. But, you know, I think once you start to integrate brake and shifter, you start locking in the ergonomics. You start losing some adjustability. A clean, minimal cockpit is awesome, but what you still want some adjustability on location of levers and angle of levers. So it's really hard to do, to combine both of those features.
Yeah. So with electronic drivetrains becoming more common, a lot of riders are wondering if mechanical systems are going to eventually go away. So what's kind of your take on that?
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting thing. I'm kind of I love the electronic shifting because of the basically the programming and the quote unquote intelligence that you get with the electronics on that. You know, the shifting is consistent and reliable. I'm kind of like a traditional guy. I do like the simplicity of cable moving a derailleur. I think you still get an awesome shift with the cable systems of today. You know, there's no charging. There are no catastrophic failures that you could experience out on the trail.
Yeah.
I think they'll both have their place. I think, you know, electronics are just going to keep getting better and better. Mm-hmm. But there'll probably be a little segment, you know, where mechanical always hangs in there.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine part of it is price too. I mean, like inexpensive kind of entry level bikes. Like, do you think electronic would ever get to that level, or does it make more sense to stick with mechanical in that situation?
I think as the manufacturing gets more sophisticated, I think they can bring the electronic down to a pretty low price point. Hmm. You know, the components, at least on the shifter side, are relatively inexpensive. You know, the derailleurs are pretty, I hate to use the term, but maybe overbuilt. Hmm. And there's a lot of expense and weight on the derailleurs.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, as manufacturing moves forward, you know, they find ways for any new technology to bring it, you know, further and further down on the price point.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, what about mechanical derailleurs? You think there's still room to improve those? Like, are we going to see lighter weight ones, or, you know, just more reliable ones in the future? Is there room for that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the derailleur, that's another thing that's just been, it's such an archaic old design.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's definitely room for improvement. I think we'll probably start to see some better mounting structures for mechanical rear derailleurs. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, you know, we can simplify some of the construction. There have been many attempts to move away from the parallelogram structure, which is super old and super archaic, but it's just super effective. You know, there's a lot of patents out there for linear moving derailleurs, or derailleurs that move on an arc track, or all kinds of anti-parallelogram derailleurs. But when you start building them and putting them out there in the, they don't hold up as well.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, you will see some improvements, but they might be, you know, minor.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned sort of the challenges, or perhaps the ability to improve how derailleurs are mounted. What makes derailleur hangers necessary? I feel like these days people especially with SRAM, you know, moving to the universal derailleur hanger and then moving to direct mount, people started saying, why did we even have derailleur hangers in the first place? Those were dumb. What was the purpose of them? And do you think we can get rid of them?
Yeah, I think we can definitely get rid of them. I mean, I love the coaxial direct mount because you're mounting the derailleur directly to the axis of the cassette, which is the component that it needs to interact with. So,
right.
You know, why not have a perfect alignment right there? I think, derailleur hangers were really just, you know, carried over from the old days, you know, when, you know, that's when old, you know, old road bikes were built with, you know, little hanger tabs. And as bikes evolved into mountain bikes, you know, with the early guys, you know, that was the tab hanging on all the frames.
Did it have something to do with like tolerances back then? Like they couldn't get all the bikes to be exactly the same, like in terms of the rear end and how that would like made up to the wheels and the cassette? Or was it to protect the derailleur? Was it all of that?
You know, I don't know. I think obviously the idea where the derailleur hanger would become an intentional fail point from impact, you know, I think that came from mountain biking. And I think that's a good thing, you know, where you wouldn't destroy your frame. Although when the derailleur gets hit and the hanger fails, where does your derailleur go? Into your rear wheel.
Right.
And that's a catastrophe. But you know, there were a lot of frame builders, a lot of independent builders, you know, all building their own dropouts and the derailleur hanger dimensions, you know, they would always move and vary. And that was, you know, that was a problem. That's why, you know, the SRAM UDH, it was a standard item, you know, made in high quantity by, you know, a solid manufacturer that really used the rear axle as its orientation point. You know, even though it was a derailleur hanger, it was oriented at the at the rear axle point. And then, I mean, ultimately, that, you know, that is the point where you want to register your derailleur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. Well, so you mentioned that the design for derailleurs has been around a long time, and obviously bikes have been around for a very long time, more than 100 years. And the basic form of bikes hasn't changed a lot. So what's your take? Like, aside from e-bikes, is the pace of innovation in the bike world slowing, accelerating? Is it kind of, have we reached a plateau?
I think, you know, I think the bike industry is just so, well, it was so steeped in traditionalism and, you know, what had come before. I mean, I think now we're starting to see, you know, some pretty interesting innovations electronically, but it's still, you know, it's still hard that to get away from some of the traditional philosophies. You know, it's amazing that we still have an exposed drivetrain.
Yeah,
you know, a chain and cogs and a, you know, a mechanical thing that moves the chain in and out. You know, it's pretty archaic. Although, you know, they're super refined and super accurate and super beautifully designed. You know, the overall concept is, it's an exposed, you know, mechanical mechanism that we're
right.
riding
yeah, where
out.
Else
we're,
do you see that?
We're riding out and nowhere, you know, we're riding out in the elements. So yeah, it's a fascinating topic.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, you're right. And it makes it interesting to me that, like, with your shifters, you're able to take something that's existed for so long and to, like, rethink it and to say, well, wait, like, why do we do it like this? Or why couldn't we improve this thing that we've all been using for a long time and we've gotten used to it and we're like, this is fine. But yeah, it's interesting that there are still these areas where we can innovate and improve.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, the shifter, the F3 shifter, it's a shifter taken like to the artisan level, you know, it's almost like, you know, performance art in a way, you know, but the construction is super solid and, you know, the mechanism is really, really robust. I wanted to come up with something that had, you know, a really nice action to it. Mm. You know, there never had been a CNC shifter before. And then there, you know, the adjustability had never been, you know, out there before.
Yeah. Well, I mean, shifters are, to me, you know, they're kind of a mystery. I mean, every now and then you get to pop one open and, you know, replace a cable and you see inside there's all these little pieces, springs and ratchets and little screws and things. So you're manufacturing and assembling the Vivo F3 shifters in the US. How's that going? Is that tricky to do?
I love doing it because I love these crazy little mechanisms. You know, I know this mechanism inside and out. Mm-hmm. I've designed, you know, so many mechanisms over the years. And I think this is one of my best. It's very basic. It works really well. Mm. It's really enjoyable and satisfying to assemble these things, you know, put the springs in place and the parts, you know, when they're fit just right. I mean, it's great. And the lubrication part of it is fun and enjoyable.
Yeah.
So I enjoy it. You know, I have kind of a library of crazy mechanisms that I have, you know, maybe some of those will come out, you know, later on. But yeah, I enjoy shifters. You know, for me, it's, you know, mechanical shifters are, you know, ergonomically, I think even more important than an electronic shifter where you're just, you know, electronic shifters, it's a fairly light touch and you're just basically, you know, clicking a button. With mechanical shifters, you know, there's more force involved. Mm-hmm. So the ergonomics and the feel are more important because you're pulling a cable. There's a little bit more force on the thumb and the fingers. And so to tune that in just right, I think is... Mm. Gives you a better ride.
Yeah. How many pieces are involved in the F3?
I think they're about between 23 or 27 pieces, somewhere in there.
Okay.
All the pieces combined, you know, that includes springs and CNC pieces and 3D printed pieces and bearings. And... Mm.
Yeah. Is this something that a buyer could service or replace a part on their own if they had an issue?
Yeah, I think so. The mechanism is completely completely disassemble it. It's fairly easy to, you know, replace a part, you know, pull a part out, you know, you can blow it out with a compressor to clean it if you want. You can re-lube it if you want. Mm. Yeah, I would say anything above the on the top end of the mechanism, you can just unbolt and then rebolt. Mm-hmm. You know, with just kind of, you know, fairly decent mechanical knowledge, you can do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's definitely one of the things that, especially a lot of older riders who started out with mechanical systems and are now seeing these electronic systems come in. You know, I mean, I think the thing that we like about the mechanical systems is that we can understand them probably a lot easier than the electronics, but two, we can work on them ourselves at home. And so, yeah, I mean, is that something that you, as like a product designer and, you know, now as someone who sells shifters, I mean, is this something that you want to like empower people to do on their own because it is mechanical and because it is kind of simple to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, giving the consumer to kind of, you know, change the paddles on the F3 shifter, that's just the first step, you know, taking control of the ergonomics there, you know, unbolting one and re-screwing in another one. If you don't like that, you change it out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, on the mechanical side, you know, all in the testing phase of the F3, you know, my rider guys, they would pull the outer housing off, mm-hmm. and, you know, relube the mechanism if needed, you know, check for wear and anything. Mm-hmm. So I think it's simple enough where someone could go in there and see what's happening.
Yeah. Right. And it's interesting because, you know, in like the sort of larger conversation about like right to repair and things, you know, you're seeing, again, like bikes are not the only industry that are seeing this, with things getting more complicated. And in a lot of other industries, it seems like companies are trying to protect their revenue streams, right? Like they only want to have their people working on their stuff. And, you know, so far in my kind of experience and impression, it seems like the bike industry is not trying to go that way, that we do have this tradition of like working on our own gear and, mm-hmm. and having these independent shops that are able to work on gear. And so, yeah, it seems like the F3 is kind of in that same vein of DIY and like letting people kind of have more control over their equipment.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I love that aspect of it. And yeah, I mean, a lot of the bike parts are kind of, you know, disposable in a way, you know, mm-hmm. once a certain part of it fails, you know, you have to throw it out and you just replace it. Yeah. You know, I like the possibility of rebuilding and retrofitting parts like that. You know, when I first started out, I would collect shifters, old shifters from Shimano and shifters from Suntour, and, you know, I'd open them up and I'd see how they work. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of crazy things out there, you know, but it all comes down to, at the bottom line, you know, on the mechanical side, you know, pulling and releasing a cable. Mm. But how you do it, you know, there are a lot of different ways to solve that.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, thought that was fascinating over the years.
Yeah. Well, how different are like Shimano and SRAM, let's say 12 speed, you know, the one that most of us are using, like, are they both pulling the cable roughly the same amount? Like, is it consistent, like from shift to shift, you're pulling it the same 1 millimeter or whatever every shift, or is it like increasing or decreasing? Like, do they both kind of handle it the same way?
Yeah. Well, they both, the SRAM and Shimano systems, in total, they're close, but they pull slightly different at certain points in the cassette. You know, roughly they do, you know, from cog to cog, they roughly pull about the same amount, but it varies. But if you look at the mechanisms, I mean, SRAM has done an awesome job, and I think they've done this throughout the years of simplifying things.
Okay.
And you know, getting an end result or an end performance, you know, with very few parts. Mm-hmm. And if you look at a Shimano shifter and you try and take that thing apart, if you don't do it correctly, it's just going to explode on you. There are so many more parts on the Shimano side, you know, that basically achieve, you know, I mean, Shimano does have a slightly different release feature where you can have a multi-release, but you know, overall, Shimano's are much more complicated than the SRAMs. And the TRP has an awesomely robust and fairly simple mechanism as well. I mean, that one was actually executed really, really well.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I'm also curious about like sort of the role that patents play in all of this. Like, and you're saying that the Shimano and the SRAM shifters are pretty similar. Is that because there aren't like patent protections in place, or they've all expired, and so everybody's able to kind of coalesce around these designs that are kind of the best designs? Like are patents, do they play a big role in how products are designed in the bike industry today?
Yeah, they play a huge role. And just to clarify, the SRAM and Shimano are only similar as far as cable pull.
Okay.
But the actual mechanisms are very different. So, yeah, the patents, and, you know, this is becoming a little bit less relevant these days because we're moving toward electronic. But the patents are huge barriers. As far as how you're going to pull and release cable. So there are lots of patents out there on the mechanisms, the internal mechanisms of how you're going to pull and release cable, also the placement of the levers. Mm-hmm. And Shimano, they're constantly filing. So it's something that you constantly have to keep up on. Mm. And basically, when you conduct your patent research and you read, you first of all, you've got to find all these things, then you've got to read them, then you have to interpret them.
And right, that's end, hard interpreting, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Because the language on some of these things is gets crazy. But basically, in the end, you're finding out, you're only finding out what you cannot do. So you can't do this, right. You can't do that, you can't do this, you can't do that. Well, what's left? Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully something that's left is valuable and, will achieve performance. So that whole thing is a big challenge.
Yeah. Interesting.
Not always fun.
Yeah. Well, so, but even something like a shifter, there's still active patents, a lot of them that you have to kind of work around, or, I mean, because patents in the US anyway, they last what, roughly 20 years or so, 17?
Yeah. 17 to 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there, there's some old ones that are still in effect. I think they're starting to file, less. Mm-hmm. Because the development on mechanical shifters is probably not progressing at the rate that it was, in past years. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you certainly need to know what not to do, because, if they want to, they'll shut you down.
Yeah. Is that common? I mean, are lawyers a big part of the industry as well, where they will be aggressive in terms of like protecting these patents?
Well, if their client, being Shimano, tells them to, they will.
Right.
Or ask them to, they will. So, yeah. And, I don't know what the factors are, whether they, when they decide to take action, mm-hmm. whether it's how many units you start to sell or who knows. But you don't want to try and guess on what that might be. So you just, you steer clear of it.
Yeah.
As best you can.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, getting back to the Vivo F3 shifters, obviously, like you said, you're manufacturing, assembling in the U.S. Do you foresee challenges with scaling that domestically? Like, it seems like a lot of brands, when they're smaller, they're able to do it in the U.S., but then you hit some point and you have to go overseas. Do you see that with shifters as well?
With what I'm doing, I'm going to intentionally keep it small.
Okay.
I don't need to blow this thing up and go crazy and, have parts, made in high quantities. So, if it were to be scaled, then I would have to probably redesign, make the parts, more economical to make, right mm-hmm. now, this was like a shifter that had no limitations. Always when I was designing for companies, there were cost parameters. Mm. We need to hit this cost, or, this part is too expensive, that part is too expensive. This is something I designed, and with no limitations, mm-hmm. I made the parts however I wanted them. It didn't matter how expensive they were going to be, because I was going to CNC them. Mm-hmm. There wasn't going to be any, big upfront tooling charges where I'm making a mold for $20,000, to stamp out, thousands and thousands of pieces. Each piece was going to be CNC'd. Mm-hmm. So this was meant to be kind of a boutique product, mm-hmm. and we'll probably, stay that way.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, which is like more, I guess the word is rewarding for you, like in terms of you personally, like, Is it more rewarding to design something with all those constraints, or are you enjoying being able to design without constraints?
Honestly, I love both. I mean, I've designed some lower cost products with Tektro that I'm very proud of. That at a low price point, we've achieved an awesome product, and that was a challenge in its own way. Mm-hmm. And those products are out there in the market, and that's an incredible feeling. And then on the crazy inside, insane high end, I like what I'm doing now. That's just as much fun, because it's it's your own creation, without limitation, mm-hmm. and it's just fun. So they've both been fun, and they're they're both rewarding.
Yeah, Yeah, that's great. Do you have plans for a front derailleur shifter, or do you think front derailleurs are pretty much dead for most riders?
Yeah, I have no plans for a front derailleur shifter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you think though that like is where we're at now, like with 12 or 13 speeds, is that going to be enough for us pretty much going forward? Or do you think there's going to be a need for like 14 or 15, or are we going to go back to having a 2x drivetrain or 3x?
Honestly, you know, that would be funny if we went to 2x and back to 3x.
So you're saying it's not going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think so, but it's just interesting when you use the word, you know, do you think we need this or need that? You know, sometimes what comes out in the market, you know, is not really what's needed, but it's just something that might be, you know, part of a marketing effort.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I definitely like the trend of simplicity that we've been on since, you know, the Eagle first came out, and, you know, removing the front derailleur, removing the front shifter, moving all, you know, more gears to the back cog.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's hard to predict, you know, the bike industry is kind of crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so what's next for Vivo? You mentioned you've got some stuff. I'm sure you don't necessarily want to give away all your secrets, but like, what are kind of the opportunities or the things that you see, or where do you want to like take this company?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm just enjoying very much working with TRP. We're doing some great stuff on TRP, both electronic and mechanical. And, you know, I'm going to continue with what I'm doing with Vivo, just coming up with, you know, out of the box components, you know, like with no limitations. You know, the F3 shifter is the first. I have some other ideas that, you know, will probably add some additional, more interesting shifting features to them.
Mm-hmm.
It'll, you know, I'll keep it like high end CNC stuff. I mean, it was a challenge to come up with a shifter that was, you know, all CNC, you know, rather than creating tooling. But also on the Vivo side, you know, I've written a book about my business experiences. I have part one of my book, which is called Shifting Gears, is out now.
Oh, great.
And it covers 30 years of, you know, my insane journey through the bike industry. Goes all the way back to, you know, those days that I mentioned earlier of driving home from the race in Mount Snow and just wondering, you know, how can I get into this industry? What can I do? And then how do I do it? Going to my first trade show and lining up buyers and manufacturers and, you know, working with Fox and FSA and Box Components and Shimano and, you know, all the crazy things that happen behind the scenes. I kind of just explain the whole deal. It's interesting.
Well, looking back, do you have any regrets about that decision to join the bike industry, or do you ever wish you're designing baby bottles still?
No. No, I mean, I pinch myself sometimes today. I'm just like, I'm so blessed to be able to do this full time. You know, this is awesome. I mean, I can go out for a ride and I'm saying, oh, you know, well, I have to ride today because I have to test some parts. And, you know, I have to ride tomorrow too, because I have to test this and that. And, oh, this, you know, this cool set of wheels came out and that cool part came out. Well, I've got to buy those because, you know, I've got to stay current with the industry.
That's right. Some research,
you know? Right. So yeah, I love it. It's great. It's really a blessing to be able to do it.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, John, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us and share a little of your experience. And hopefully we'll have to check out your book as well.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much for the time. I really had fun.
Yeah. So you can get more info, check out the shifters at vivocycling.com, and we'll have that link in the show notes. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.